right. This morning we have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket, Brunson v. Johnson and then RCS Enterprises versus Hilton. We call the first case on our docket, Brunson v. Johnson. If the clerk will please announce counsel. All right, Ms. Faust.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. Appellant Dr. Brunson brings his interlocutory appeal here to this court challenging the expert report reports that were furnished and served by Mr. Johnston in the lawsuit that was filed. These reports were served timely, so there's no challenge with respect to any of the timing or procedural requirements. The challenges here involve the sufficiency, that is, whether the expert reports were legally sufficient to meet the standards under Section 74351, and if not, whether the trial court then abused its discretion in failing to grant the challenge and the motion to dismiss. The first report that was served in this case was really served prior to the expiration of the 120-day deadline, and that was the report of Dr. Lustgarten. The defendant, Dr. Brunson, timely filed several objections to that report, including that Dr. Lustgarten was not qualified to render opinions on standard of care and breach, and thus none of his opinions that could be stated in that report should be considered by the court in determining whether or not he had met the requirements of Section 74351. After that time, the plaintiff then timely served the expert report of Dr. Shalen, and Dr. Shalen's report was then objected to by Dr. Brunson timely with respect to his causation opinions. And so today in this court, we are asking the court to look at the sufficiency of the causation opinions in Dr. Shalen's report, and to the extent that, as we know now, the appellees have asserted Dr. Lustgarten's report is sufficient, we have also challenged that report for two reasons. First, it can't be considered at all because Dr. Lustgarten rendered his causation opinions based on his standard of care and breach determinations, and because he was not qualified to render opinions on standard of care and breach, the court cannot then consider those causation opinions because they weren't not tied to the breaches of the standard of care that were stated in Dr. Shalen's report that came much later. But even if the court does look at Dr. Lustgarten's report, then it is also conclusory and speculative, which are the challenges that we've asserted here today. Now, looking first at whether Dr. Lustgarten was qualified to render opinions on standard of care and breach, again, the reason that's important here is because, remember, Dr. Lustgarten's report was the first report served. And then only upon the objection of Dr. Brunson did Dr. Shalen much later come in and render and provide a sufficient report, allegedly sufficient report. Dr. Lustgarten is not qualified here to render opinions if we look at Section 74401, which governs how a physician is qualified to render an opinion on standard of care and breach in the context of Section 74351. And specifically, we're looking at here the qualification that the expert is a physician who is practicing medicine at the time such testimony is given or was practicing medicine at the time the claim arose. And that's Section 74401A. That part of the section, the statute, has to be shown either in the expert report or the CV, looking at both of those only. In looking at the expert report and the CV, what do we know about Dr. Lustgarten? Well, at the time of the care at issue in 2009, June of 2009, and at the time of the submission of the report in 2011, his employment was in a position as expert medical advisor.
He said he was in private practice.
Yes, in private practice.
Since 1976. How is that not adequate to say he was practicing at both relevant times?
Because he needs to state that he's practicing medicine with regard to the medical care at issue.
He says neurosurgery.
Well, but he doesn't say how neurosurgery applies to the radiology issues in this case. And that's a second challenge to Dr. Lustgarten. He's a neurosurgeon, and he does not explain anywhere Your Honor, in either the CV or the expert report as to how it is a neurosurgeon acquires by training experience or his knowledge base the information that would be applicable that a radiologist should know and should use in reviewing those x-rays. He says he does it. He says he is aware of what's required, but he doesn't show in his expert report or his CV how he is knowledgeable and how he knows that he is qualified. And this court has stated even prior to the enactment of House Bill 4 in 2003 in the case of In re Windisch, this court said that conclusory statements that I'm qualified doesn't give the trial court the information it needs to know that the expert is qualified as to the medical issue and the treatment that is at issue in the lawsuit. And so that, Your Honor, is why we say that just practicing medicine at that time is just not enough to show that he's qualified.
Even though he says in neurosurgery.
Correct, Your Honor, because he doesn't say how a neurosurgeon acquires the knowledge, the skill, or the experience to read x-rays that a radiologist would perform in reading the x-rays. He needs to state that or show that. And nowhere on his CV does he show that he's had training as a radiology or neuroradiology to link those two together, because the treatment at issue in this case with respect to Dr. Brunson is as a radiologist reading those that MRI that was initially taken.
What about on page 8 of what? Well, it says page 8 of his letter report under the title Dr. Brunson. He says, as a neurosurgeon, through my training, experience, and education, I have been thoroughly exposed to neuroradiology as it pertains to interpretation of lumbar MRI scans of the type performed by Mr. Johnson in this case on June 9, 2009.
Your Honor, we think under the case of In re Windisch, that's still conclusory. If you look at, I mean, he can say that he's qualified. He can make that assertion that he's qualified, but he hasn't shown how he's obtained that knowledge. So for that reason, we would argue, and the fact that he's not shown that he's actively practicing medicine at the time regarding the carrot issue.
Well, that I take issue with, because it's pretty clear when someone says they have been practicing, he says, I've been in private practice of neurosurgery since 1976. That, with proper English grammar, that's a present tense expression, that he's been doing something since 1976, and it's continuous until now.
But what his CV shows that he's been doing at the time of the care and at the time of his report is that he was an expert medical advisor, and those are the two time periods that you look at. If that's practicing medicine, he doesn't state how it's actively practicing medicine. Practicing medicine is defined in the statute specifically, Your Honor, to be training.
It doesn't include
training.
Private practice?
It would include private practice, Your Honor, if that's what, I mean, he can make that conclusory statement. Under Windisch, though, if that conclusory statement is not enough without showing what that private practice is. And what his CV shows that private practice is at the two time periods at issue in this case are as an expert medical advisor, without explaining what that is. Now, if you look at, even if you look at and consider Dr. Lustgarten's report, though, Your Honors, we still believe that that report is conclusory and speculative, and Dr. Shalen's report is also conclusory and speculative on the issue of causation. Now, what Dr. Lustgarten says in his report with respect to causation is that, I'm sorry, just one moment. I lost my place here. What he says is that had Dr. Brunson met the standard of care that he's laid out, the standard of care, the the way that Dr. Brunson allegedly breached the standard of care was in failing to identify a lesion, recommend follow-up imaging, and make a recommendation or a referral to a neurosurgeon. Those are the ways he says he's breached the standard of care. So then Dr. Lustgarten comes in and says, had he met the standard of care, then Mr. Johnston would have undergone emergency decompression of the spine prior to the onset of the permanent paraplegia 3 days later. Stated another way, the evolution of Mr. Johnston's symptoms created a circumstance whereby if Dr. Brunson had met the standard of care, appropriate surgical intervention could have been performed prior to the onset of the damages on June 12th that were then irresolvable. Now, looking at that, it is both speculative and conclusory. It's speculative because the trial court had to infer or guess that if Dr. Brunson had identified this lesion and had referred him, Mr. Johnston, to a neurosurgeon, then these subsequent two physicians, in fact, a neurosurgeon did look at him and did look at him the next day and looked at that MRI and did not see the lesions, that they would have found it, they would have agreed to those findings, and that Mr. Johnston required surgical intervention, that the surgical intervention would have been timely performed, and it would have been successful.
But what your statement, I think, ignores is the fact that had either one of them been told that a prior physician had seen or found this lesion or whatever this abnormality was, they would have looked for that maybe more carefully than perhaps they did.
Well, that doesn't go... Respectfully, Your Honor, that is not the causation opinion of Dr. It is a speculation that Dr. Lustgarten makes, and he cannot speculate that those physicians would have looked harder. In fact, the neurosurgeon, and again, Dr. Lustgarten is a neurosurgeon, if he's qualified to render these opinions on what those doctors should do, that neurosurgeon should do, then... And he's made opinions about Dr. Masaccio in this case and as the neurosurgeon and how he breached the standard of care. But that is speculation to say that Dr. Masaccio, based on what Dr. Brunson should or should not have done, would then lead Dr. Masaccio to make different diagnoses. That is speculation. Dr. Masaccio did not make those and looked at the MRI himself.
But wouldn't that perhaps happen in every scenario then, when the first doctor who looks at somebody perhaps makes a mistake, but there are then subsequent physicians and they make the same mistake? In other words, it seems like your argument would almost always make it impossible for a first doctor who made a diagnostic mistake to ever become liable, or at least to pass the muster of the expert report requirements.
Well, I think also, and I appreciate that, Your Honor, and yes, it is a concern, but under the statute, the expert is required to address causation under Jelinek to state that it's a substantial factor and show how Dr. Brunson's care was and breach of the standard of care was a substantial factor in the permanent paralysis in this case. Dr. Lustgarten even notes that the symptoms eased and they went away on the very next day. Then they reoccurred again. So he doesn't explain then what Dr. Brunson should have done in that context. So he's ignoring the facts, not explaining what happened during the delay of that three-day period. The other courts, and specifically the Chenoy versus Jones case that we have cited to the court, it is a unpublished opinion out of Houston, but it is something the court can look to. And also the court can look to the cases that the appellee has cited, the George case out of this court and the Garcia case out of this court, where they specifically talked about what happened during the delay. That did not occur in this case, either with respect to Dr. Lustgarten or with respect to Dr. Shalen, whose report was even more conclusory, and it was much more like the report in the Bowie versus Wright case. In other words, if you would have complied with the standards of care, you would have had a better outcome. You would have determined the abnormality at issue. But Dr. Shalen doesn't even say where it was, when it should have, how it would have been identified on June 9th when Dr. Brunson looked at that MRI. So for these...
He does say...
Yes, Your Honor? Please.
He does say, though, that this 12-hour 12-hour window of time during which he says the emergency surgery could have been performed to relieve the pressure, that 12-hour time was... It passed during those 3 days and without an operation. So, I mean, he does say that, and that seems to me to be very, it's not like...
Dr. Lustgarden?
Yes.
What...
He's saying, well, that there's some unlimited period of time that if he had done a proper reading and if he had, had referred him to... another neurosurgeon to operate at some, but it doesn't say when. I mean, we've got a window of time that we're dealing with, 12 hours. So when the 12 hours passed, it was, it didn't matter that there were 3 days that nothing was done. Nothing was done during the 12-hour period, and that's what's critical.
May I answer? I see my time's expired.
Yes, please.
Answer. Yes, Your Honor, he says that. But the reason that that's conclusory is because, and really it leads to the speculation that he says that that 12-hour period would have resulted in a referral to a neurosurgeon, the neurosurgeon identifying the specific abnormality, treating it, saying surgical intervention was required, performing the surgery within that 12-hour period, and that the surgery would have been successful. And that's too much speculation that has not been tied to the specific facts in this case, Your Honor, to, we think, under the prevailing case law, to show that it meets the requirements.
Well, if something wasn't done, and you say it should have been done, and if it had been done, this would be the likely outcome, what, you would never call it anything but speculation.
Well, Your Honor,
it wasn't done.
Yes, Your Honor, but in the Texas Supreme Court said in Bowie versus Wright that that's just not enough. You can't say that the failure to do something proximately caused the result.
Well, what would you say?
You would have to, for example, in the George case and the Garcia case out of this court, what the experts talked about was what occurred during the times of the delay. They tied the facts to the very, for example, in the George case, it was a post-surgical onset of neurological...
Yeah, I understand that, but if something is not done that needed to be done that would have changed the outcome,
well, Your Honor,
because it wasn't done, you're always going to argue it was speculation.
But with respect to Dr. Brunson, who's a radiologist, he cannot perform that surgery within 12 hours. He's a radiologist. He has to make a referral to a neurosurgeon. A neurosurgeon did come in and didn't find that on the MRI. He has to then have the neurosurgeon agree with that diagnosis, perform surgery, and correct it within the 12-hour period. And that's too much speculation with respect to the radiologist. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, Ms. Faust, thank you. If the clerk will please add an additional 1 minute to Mr. Harvey's time, whether you use it or not. You don't have to, but if you want to. Thank you.
May it please this honorable court and counsel. I want us to focus back, as this court will, is was Judge Evans acting within his discretion in concluding? Is there guiding information here to tell Judge Evans that the statutory requirements have been met? As Justice Gardner has pointed out, the report says, I've been in private practice. I tried to think of a similarity. I completed my walk over here at 8:40, and I've been in the courtroom since 8:45. I'm still here. Just as Dr. Lustgarden said, I completed my residency in 73, and I've been in the private practice of neurosurgery since 1976. And contrary to what counsel says, identifies on his CV that he is the attending, continues to be the a senior attending at Parkway and North Jackson Hospital. That's detailed information to direct, to allow Judge Evans to conclude that Dr. Lustgarden was practicing medicine at the time.
And that's doesn't the term attending have some normal usage or common usage in the medical profession?
That the attending is the physician that supervises other physicians, residents, fellows, interns. So as the he identifies in his CV that I am a senior attending in both facilities, which meets the statutory requirement. The next challenge in regard to his qualifications, and frankly was troubling to me because this court should be able to rely on what we tell the court. And counsel identified as quoting from Dr. Lustgarten's report by stating, this is on page 12 of the brief, "As a neurosurgeon, I have been thoroughly exposed to neuroradiology." That's not what Dr. Lustgarten said. What Dr. Lustgarten said was, as a neurosurgeon, through my training, experience, and education, I have been thoroughly. Counsel omitted critical clauses out of the report without indicating to the court of any, that any omission of that data, of that information. That makes it clear that Dr. Lustgarten was practicing medicine, was educated, trained, and experienced, not in general radiology, nor have we tried to make him that, but I am familiar with the standard of care of a radiologist interpreting this type of film. Interpretation of a lumbar MRI scan is what I'm expected to be able to do. That is tying his experience directly to the facts of this case, notwithstanding counsel's omission of that in her quotes. We think the argument that of his qualifications is, we believe Judge Evans had adequate information before him to determine that Dr. Lustgarten was qualified. To say that Dr. Lustgarten has to be a neuroradiologist or radiologist to tell what the standard of care is, this court's seen all the long line of cases that say you don't have to have the same specialty. He shows, I've got the same experience doing the same type of thing because of my experience in neurosurgery on these issues. I know what's supposed to happen. These lesions are supposed to be identified. And he explains why. Because you have to do decompressive surgery on the spinal cord to prevent paraplegia. Was Judge Evans acting within his discretion to conclude that that advised Dr. Brunson? Here's what we're complaining about, Dr. Brunson. You failed to identify a lesion, and because of that, decompressive surgery was not done, and as a result of that, paraplegia resulted. Was Judge Evans, was he within his discretion to think that's what this report told Dr. Brunson? Well, of course he was, because that's what the report tells Dr. Brunson. And then to figure out, well, how did it cause it? Both Dr. Lustgarten by saying, because of the failure to decompress the spine, and as Dr. Shalin said, because of the failure to timely intervene, ischemia continued to cause injury to the spinal cord. That gives, in this early part of the case, Dr. Brunson plenty of information to understand what the claim is against him, and for sure, Judge Evans was reasonable and relying upon data before him to conclude the report is good.
How does the fact that his symptoms apparently dissipated, which appellants mentioned,
of course, that's,
for a short time?
Frankly, that's beneficial for our case because what that says is, had these doctors acted in a timely fashion they had 2 days to do it, had they acted in a timely fashion, the ultimate paraplegia would have been avoided. This isn't one of those just 12-hour cases. Dr. Lustgarten says, hey, when you identify this, you act within 12 hours. That's what you're supposed to do. And if you do that, results are good. However, what we learned in this case is he had early onset of symptoms that were transient and identified the source of those symptoms by the defect of the clonus seen on the MRI, telling the physicians, had you acted timely? This isn't a situation where I'd have to come in and prove, well, you had an hour to make a difference. That delay helps us. So let's think now what the appellant indicates. In order to overcome the speculation that she says exists in this report, as I hear what appellant is saying, is that we have to be able to prove that if Dr. Brunson would have identified the abnormality, then neurosurgery would have responded by agreeing that it's there, would have operated, and then the operation would have been successful. All without the opportunity, because of the statute, to take anybody's deposition. So what counsel wants to say is, you've got to get the neurosurgeon to say, oh, if the radiologist had told me, I would have seen it, I would have operated, and everything would have been okay. But yet, I can't take his deposition. Well, this court has been faced with that very same thing in Foster, I don't believe Foster was from this court, but these cases, all quoting Moore versus Sutherland, say, holding that an expert report based upon a doctor's misdiagnosis is sufficient as to causation when it specifically states what the defendant should have done and what happened because he failed to do it. Well, these reports have all identified how he failed to identify, and what happened because of it was surgical intervention was never undertaken. That's the same holding in George. It's the same holding in Garcia versus Allen, again quoting Moore. I mean, the similarities between Garcia versus Allen in this case are dramatic, in that it's the failure to recognize, and in that case, Justice Livingston, you wrote the opinion, was that the tumor was inoperable in 1999, but it was, had it been operated earlier, it would have been, I may have my date wrong, but that I believe it was inoperable in 99, but it was operable when the film showed it and was missed. This court did not require, for the causation opinion, that the report say, and had the doctor identified that to the surgeon agrees he would have operated, and the surgeon agrees that within probability the results would have been different. That's not the standard. Think of that. In every radiology case, we see a frank broken arm on an X-ray, and the doctor misses it. And therefore, unless you have the orthopedist come in and say, I would have done it. I mean, it's just impossible. It's an impossible position to think that radiologists have that kind of immunity, because they don't. And this court has identified it. You have to identify what was missed and what resulted therefrom. Our reports do that. Dr. Shalen specifically says, because of the failure to identify, it allowed ischemia of the spinal cord to continue, and that led to the paraplegia. That tells Dr. Brunson what the problem is.
I do have a problem with his statement at the end of page 9 of his report.
Brunson. Okay. I mean, Lustgarden or Shalen?
Lustgarden. Where he says this, meaning surgery, I guess, if it had been discovered and operated on, would have afforded Mr. Johnston with an opportunity for a definitive surgical correction and resolution of the mass in his spinal cord before it reached the point of causing blah, 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 paraplegia. That does sound an awful lot like the Bowie Hospital versus Wright case, where the expert said that the patient would have had a possibility of a better outcome.
As you'll see in the full body of the report, talking about Dr. Masciato and Dr. Darnuel, or however he says his name, that The source of the blood clot could have been identified, treated with definitive surgery at the time when the symptoms were merely transient and involving the left leg. By failing to meet the standard of care, for Mr. Johnson left him with paralysis and paraplegia. He says it two or three times, I think a couple of times later on, even specifically says that intervention of the surgery would have prevented this paraplegia. And you'll see on here, even on page 9, I believe it says, if emergency decompression of the spine is performed on those patients who have hematoma in their spinal canal within the first 12 hours of symptoms, more likely than not, such decompression will result in restoration of neurologic function and stabilization of the patient such to a degree they are no longer paraplegic. So it's not just as in the Bowie case saying it possibly would have made a difference. He's saying if you operate within that period of time, more likely than not, these patients are not going to have this problem. We believe that this report justifies Judge Evans' opinion, decision, that the report is adequate. And that's, of course, what this court's job is not to insert your opinions as to whether or not what your conclusions would have been, but was Judge Evans, was there controlling information here for Judge Evans? And we believe the report does. We'll rely on our briefing and look forward to the court's decision.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harvey. Ms. Faust.
Just a couple of response points, Your Honors. First of all, with regard to Dr. Lustgarten's qualification, the fact that he is a senior attending, if the court looks at his CV, it doesn't say that he's practicing. It says he's affiliated with that hospital under that. It doesn't say that he was performing that work at the time in 2009 of this care or at the time of that he rendered the report in 2011. It says he's affiliated with that hospital.
But don't they usually use a term like that because they're just, quote, on staff? They're usually not employees of the hospital.
They're rarely employees of the hospital, correct, Your Honor.
What other word could they have used?
Well, he would need to show what he was doing at the time in 2009, and he could take this CV and state in his expert report, at the time of the patient's care, I was performing surgery for the same type of decompression surgery that Mr. Johnston required in this case, or at the time that he wrote the report that he was actively practicing. So that there are ways he could have taken his CV and added it to his report, because that's what the court gets to look at, both the CV and the report. And the fact, all we can tell, because he doesn't explain it in the report, is that what he was doing at that time, we can see later on in his CV that he is this EMA, but he does not explain what that was. But it does appear to be during the time period. But he does not explain what that was to show that it was then sufficiently tied to the care and treatment at issue as to the radiologist, Dr. Brunson. So just wanting to make sure that the court does look at that CV, and that is at page 12 of the clerk's record. And then with respect to the delay in the court asked, well, what does it mean that the symptoms resolved and during this transient period? And then there was an explanation about how that actually helped the case. Well, unfortunately, that's not in any of these reports. The judge may have heard all that, but these experts aren't saying that. And if the experts would have said that during that period, it actually showed that he did require surgery, and we know that because by June 12th, he's now has the deficits that are showing that it is irreversible. But that information is nowhere in these reports, and so the court can't infer that. And then in looking at why we're saying that you have to speculate, and the trial court has to speculate about this surgery being performed in the appropriate time period, and that it would have been successful, is because that's what Dr. Lustgarten says, is that he had to have decompression surgery. And Dr. Brunson cannot perform that. He's a radiologist. And then one other issue I think they raised in their briefs, Your Honors, is that they should be entitled to an extension to cure. Now, with respect to Dr. Lustgarten, if this court concludes he's not qualified, then yes, they would be able to obtain an opinion from an expert on the standard of care and breach. But this court would then be relegated to looking at Dr. Shalen's report. And we believe under the Fung versus Fisher case that came out following the Scoresby case out of the Texas Supreme Court, that when you have a conclusory or speculative opinion, it is legally insufficient, just as it would be if it was evidence at trial, and therefore it is no report and no extension of time would be appropriate under Scoresby. And that's the final thing that we like to bring to the attention of the court. Again, we would ask the court to reverse the trial court's denial of the motion to dismiss. And we thank the court for the court's opportunity to hear oral argument in this case today.
All right, Ms. Faust, thank you for your arguments. Thank you, Mr. Harvey, as well. We appreciate you all being here. We appreciate your briefing as well. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. We will go on to and call our next case and give everybody a few minutes.